Hi everyone, it's Manny here. We've got a very special episode for you today. We're sharing our conversation with co-showrunner Erica Lassan-Mittman. Also, just wanted to mention that we do try to keep spoilers to a minimum as much as we can, but they did creep in this time. So if you haven't watched the end of the show, please watch the rest of the show, then come back and listen to the interview. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the interview.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a special interview from Back in a Lifeboat. Today we are very, very happy to have Erica Mittman with us, who was a writer and showrunner for season two of Timeless. Erica, thank you for coming.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
So jumping right in, can you tell us more about how you started writing for TV and how you got involved with Timeless specifically?
Sure. I mean, I wanted to write for TV actually from the time I was a kid. I was a big TV fan. I love watching TV. TV was very important to me growing up. And, it was what I wanted to do. And I started out, I went to college and I studied theater actually. And I moved out here as soon as I graduated, out here being Los Angeles. And I started by doing internships and then writer's assistant jobs. I worked as a writer's assistant on the show Dawson's Creek, which was my first actual job on a TV show, which was very exciting. And I learned a lot of what I know there. And I learned a lot about television writing from working as an assistant on TV shows. And I did that for a while. And then I got my first staff writing job on a show called South of Nowhere, which was a teen soap for what was then called The N. It was like the Nickelodeon teen network. And from there I worked on shows like Medium, like Dexter, and Elementary. And ultimately I met with Sean and Eric on Timeless, and as soon as I saw the pilot, I knew it was a show that I desperately wanted to work on because I am a big fan of history. I'm a big fan of time travel. And I saw how well done the pilot was, and I knew I absolutely wanted to work on the show. And luckily, Sean and Eric wanted to hire me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's super cool. So what was like your role in the writer's room in season one? Is like you were a showrunner on season two, but like what was your role through the first season?
For the first season, I was what's called a co-executive producer. I was one of the upper level writers in the room. So I was one of the writers and also helped some of the younger writers get their scripts. We work very collaboratively in television. So we all work together in the writer's room and develop the stories together, and then the individual writer goes off and writes the actual episode.
Moving forward, so the first episode that you're credited as writer was Stranded, and it was set in France in the mid 1700s. So how did you how was like that time period decided? How did you land on it?
Oh, well, Stranded, oh my god, it was so much fun because we had always in the beginning of the season, we talked about kind of what we call our blue sky phase, where we just talk about what kind of stories we want to do, just anything. And we definitely liked the idea of being stranded in time and the lifeboat getting damaged. And what are we going to do? How are we going to get out of there? And we thought the most fun time period to do, to be stranded in would be to go back pretty far before like there would be any easy technology fixes. And so I don't even remember now who came up with 1754, but it definitely seemed like a fun idea. At one point in developing the story, I kid you not, we were going to have Benjamin Franklin help us get the lifeboat back working again. But we decided to simplify the story. There was a whole journey to Philadelphia to go find him and have him help us rebuild the lifeboat. But we decided to just make it Rufus. And we decided we liked the simplicity of the story of just, we're in trouble. And we just need these like three things to fix the lifeboat. And Rufus being like, even if I find these things, I do not know if I can fix it. And sort of that kind of jeopardy. And we really just landed on it being more of an emotional story than a plot-driven story, where they all, get captured by the Shawnee tribe, who are like, "What are you guys doing here?" And we get captured, and that being captured gave us the opportunity to have the characters, talk about their past and, kind of reflect on their lives for a minute because they think they might die, and on their friendship that is building. And so we thought that was ultimately a better story than having a bunch of plot machinations trying to get to Philadelphia and find Ben Franklin.
No, it was a great story.
Yeah.
So like you said, like the one of the big thing of this episode is the conflict within the team. What was it important for the characters to go through this at this point?
Well, we had, this was fairly early still in the show's run, and like the friendships hadn't been quite as cemented as they become. And we needed for, especially for Rufus, who had been, kind of assigned to do this thing. He'd been asked to record everybody by Mason, and at that point, his loyalty was a little more to Mason than it was to these new people that he's just met. And over the course of the episode, they that friendship develops, and at a certain point in the episode, Rufus chucks the recorder, I think, in like a swamp in 1754, never to be found again, because his his relationship with Lucy and Wyatt has changed.
Fair enough. Actually, just like a small detail that, like, from that episode, which I really love, is like the Pennsylvania orb incident at the end, where it's like they all where they draw the lifeboat. So that was just a really fun
That
bit
is
from
hilarious.
that episode.
Yeah.
So okay, coming out of like that episode into like more of the season as a whole, this is just a question that we're curious about, and we talked about it in when we covered the episode, the capture of Benedict Franklin. Obviously, like, we're introduced to David Rittenhouse, the founder of Rittenhouse, and so we know that he was like a real person, I believe. I believe he was the U.S. Treasury Secretary or something like that. But we were curious, like, why you chose him as the founder of Rittenhouse.
I mean, I didn't choose that. That goes back to, you'd have to interview Sean and Eric about that one. Because I think I don't really know why. I don't know why he was chosen. I think we were just picking somebody. I think at the time we were just picking somebody from history. Oh, you know what it was? I take it back. It was because the Rittenhouse family, there was clockmakers, I believe, in that family. And so we thought it was a nod to time and clocks and that the fact that that family was a family of clockmakers, I think was the reason that I think was the reason the Rittenhouse family was chosen.
Yeah, we
Yes, that's
we
fair
kind of
enough.
dug up a little bit on the history, and like we couldn't find any dubious or
No,
like
they're not really
nefarious
evil in real
history. I'm
life.
like,
That
oh,
was
that's
that
interesting.
part's fiction.
Yeah. So through season one, we're kind of getting to know the world, all the characters, and we're slowly getting some details about how Rittenhouse works. And I was we were wondering like what's the inspiration behind the working of Rittenhouse, about the organization in general?
I mean, that's a hard question to answer. What was the inspiration behind the organization of Rittenhouse? I mean, I know that I can say that in season two, we really liked, sort of changing it up a little bit. And in season two, we decided to make them, kind of be like sleeper cells in time. And we thought that was something new and different that we hadn't done before. So there, and we put Emma more sort of in a leadership position there at the time. But season one, we didn't really know that much about the workings of Rittenhouse because at that point in the story, Flynn was the villain. And Flynn was telling us there's these terrible people called Rittenhouse, but we didn't know whether or not to believe him because, as far as we knew, he was the bad guy, we being, Lucy and Wyatt and the team. So we didn't, I don't think we revealed very much about how Rittenhouse was organized or how it worked in season one. And we kind of dove into that season two, where Emma kind of takes charge in her own way. She kind of, decides, okay, I'm in charge here. And she kind of reorganizes a little bit and sends out those sleeper cells throughout history to do their bidding rather than doing these one mission at a time, see what we can do, see if the bad guy, see if our team stops them, that sort of thing. So I hope that answers your question.
Fair enough. No, that makes sense. Did you guys have like conversations though, like about those kinds of like about th these kinds of groups that sort of like control like or like that have tried to control other groups of people? Like, did you in the writer's room, did you have those sort of conversations?
I mean, we definitely talked a lot about what does Rittenhouse want, what is their agenda, because we kind of, we came into the story as, like I said, Flynn was the bad guy, and on network television, you're only given so much time before the episode, before you have to just start making episodes. So we knew early on, like, okay, Flynn's the villain. He's talking about these Rittenhouse people. Is this real or not? We kind of had to, figure that out as we went along, what we were going to make Rittenhouse into and what they were going to be. And it evolved over time. We talked about, we did talk about the forces that are, that are controlling history. We talk about, the like different mythical like Illuminati kind of things. Like we talked about that, and we wanted Rittenhouse to be like our version of those, those sort of, arguably fictional groups throughout history, people, there's a lot of mythology around these, forces that are controlling things and, people who are really pulling the strings. And so we were playing with that mythology.
You were talking about Emma, played by the late great Annie Wersching. Can you talk a bit about the decision to bring her in?
Oh my gosh. Annie Wersching is so missed. Annie Wersching was a phenomenal actress. We brought her
Sure was.
in season one. In season one, it was just like, we always had this idea that one at some point we would go back to a time period in history and we would find somebody who had been living there. And for a long time we were calling that character the pilot. Like it was going to be a pilot for a long time. It was going to be a like a life like a time traveling pilot who got stuck there. And it evolved over time. And then but we knew we wanted to have somebody who had been like chilling out in the 1800s for like 10 years. And when we finally got to make the episode, we were trying to figure out who that was, and I think probably we had had like a lot of male guest stars at the time. And we were like, what if we did a woman this time, because if we just like to, mix it up, and we're kind of teeing up our season two where we really focused on women and minorities, and but we were like, what if it's a woman who's been stuck there and having to fend for herself in the 1800s? And that's where it came out of. And Annie was just a name that was brought to us by casting. We all loved her. We thought she was fantastic. We cast her. I don't believe she had to audition. I think we just cast her off the her body of work. And what I want to say about Annie Wersching is when we did the movie, when we came back to do the Timeless movie, the last, the final episodes, we had to everybody's contracts had run out. We had to get everybody back just because they wanted to come back. We had no contracts on everybody. We couldn't pay anybody anymore. It was really just like a labor of love for everybody. And I was trying to figure out, like, obviously, if you've seen the finale, which I'm sure you have, a lot of it was built, it hinged on Emma coming back. It hinged on us having Emma for the finale. And I wrote to her, and I was like, and we all knew that at the time, Annie Wersching was like 8 months pregnant. And we were like, okay, is she going to be willing to even come back and do this? How are we going to hide the pregnancy? Are we going to write in the pregnancy? No, we're not, because we want to kill her, and that would be sad. And and I wrote to her, and she was like, I'm in, I'm coming back, I can do it. Like, let's just schedule it around this. And like, if you could do my scenes early, great, just in case I give birth. She was 9 months pregnant when we shot that finale. And we were
Wow.
working till 3 o'clock in the morning, and she was there for it. We'd be like, Annie, do you need a chair? And she was like, nope, I'm good. Like, she is the toughest woman I have ever known. Like, I was so impressed with her and her work, and the work that she did in that finale was fantastic. And I'm really sad that she's gone.
She's extremely missed. She was a phenomenal actress in everything she did.
Definitely.
Yeah. Go
Oh,
ahead.
sorry. Kind of coming in towards the end of the season, one of the major, well, pretty much the major plot twist in the finale is with Carol being revealed to be a member of Rittenhouse. And so was Carol always meant to be Rittenhouse, or did that kind of like become clearer as the season went on?
I know that when they wrote the pilot, the Sean and Eric had the idea that Lucy's father was in Rittenhouse. That was always in their kind of mythology. And then it was something I actually believe I pitched in the room, and I said, "What if her mom is Rittenhouse too?" And we all liked the idea of Carol being Rittenhouse. So from very early on, that was an idea from very early on in the season. And so we kind of knew then where we were going, and it kind of gave us that landing point for the season. Like, we're pointing towards the end of the season when we're going to reveal that and Lucy's going to find out that her mother is Rittenhouse. And in the middle of the season, she finds out who her father is and that he's Rittenhouse. And that's less traumatic because her father was somebody she never knew in the first place. He was a stranger to her. So, but having her mother, the person that she loved and trusted, and in whose footsteps she followed as a historian, like, and somebody who she believed revered history as much as she did, be a part of Rittenhouse, we knew that that would really be like the thing that would, throw Lucy for a loop. And I was lucky enough to get to write the finale that season and write that scene with the two of them. It was a big scene. We were shooting it till, oh my gosh, it was very late. I don't remember what time it was, but I know we were hitting the 14-hour mark of shooting, and the ADs were like, "I'm gonna have to cut you off. We're gonna have to cut you off." And we reached a point where it was like the AD, because there are rules, there are labor laws and stuff, and it's the AD's jobs to cut us off when we reach a certain time. And we were shooting up in Canada that season, and the AD in Canada was like, "Look, we have to cut you off. We have literally like 2 more minutes." And I remember holding my breath, like, Abby has to nail this monologue. She has to get the monologue right because we have to get it on film, or like, the cameras are going off. And she did it. She nailed it.
Yeah, one of the biggest plot twists in my TV history, at least as a watcher. It was so well done. Moving on a bit to season two. So you did become showrunner in season two. What was the transition like from season one?
Well, we were canceled and uncanceled twice, actually. So
Yes.
that was we didn't know the fate of the show. I was interviewing for other jobs. We all were, and then we found out we were canceled, and I had interviewed for a job, and I was literally about to take another job. And then 3 days later, we were uncanceled, and I had to call my agents and be like, "Sorry, I'm going back to Timeless." Like, and they were like, "But we have this other job for you. It's a show running job." And I was like, at the time, I was just like, "I know, but I love this show. I'm going back to Timeless." So I did it, and then once a few days had gone by, Tom Smuts and I learned that, because Sean was at this point, Sean was off working on SWAT, Eric was working on The Boys, and so they didn't have time to be full-time showrunners on Timeless, and they were, deciding what they were going to do. And we kind of raised our hands and said, "Hey, how about us?" And they allowed us, they gave us the chance. It was both of our first time showrunning, so it was really, it's really something I deeply appreciate from them giving us that opportunity, even though we hadn't done it before, to take the reins of the show. But it was nice because we were show running, but kind of with training wheels, because Sean and Eric were around. They weren't running the show day to day anymore, but they were available to us. They were around for questions. And it was helpful for really learning the process, and helped me grow and learn a lot as a showrunner.
Yeah, no, that's a really good experience. So you said in past interviews that season two was really you wanted to really explore people that history has overlooked. Can
Yes.
you talk a bit more about that and how you chose some of the historical figures for season two?
Well, what happened was when we changed it, when we got picked up for season two, we moved the show to LA for a variety of reasons, and but that did make the show more expensive. And so we knew from the get-go in season two that we wouldn't be able to do as many big set pieces like the Alamo, or the Hindenburg. Like, we knew we weren't going to be able to do those kind of we weren't going to be able to execute those things well, and we didn't want to do anything that we couldn't execute well and make it look good. As you've seen, our show looks very good for a time travel show. We didn't want anything to ever look cheap or bad. And so what we decided for season two was that we were going to focus more on people. Who are we going to meet rather than what's going to be our big, like visual set piece kind of thing. And so we decided to focus on people. And what we had found towards the end of season one was, like, in doing all of our research for Timeless, we'd all spend a lot of time reading, sort of untold stories about history, maybe things people didn't know. And one of the things that really became obvious very quickly was that most of the untold stories of history were stories of the contributions of women and minorities, because history has always been told from a very white male perspective. And we felt like, if we're going to tell untold stories of history, let's tell, let's bring some of these people to light. And I feel like there was a movement of that going on in the world as well. It wasn't just us, but we were slightly ahead of the curve. Like, we did Katherine Johnson right before Hidden Figures came out. Like, we did Harriet Tubman before that, right before that Harriet Tubman movie came out. Like, we were like, we're on the edge here, and Hedy Lamarr and all those other stories. We just felt like we just felt there was we were barely scratching the surface, and there was something interesting there about not only just, interesting storytelling, getting to help tell pieces of history that people don't already know, and shining a light on people whose stories were maybe less told. And it was something that everybody in the room wanted to do. It was something that we loved about Timeless being a different kind of time travel show that felt like the right place to do it. We had a time travel show that's intentionally, on the part of Sean and Eric, they created it, featured a white man, a white woman, and a black man going back in time. And and instead of, like, traditionally time travel didn't focus on these things, and we were one of the first shows that really made time travel about, like, hey, what is it like for a black man to go back to the 1930s? What is it like for a woman to be in the 1700s? And so we felt like our show was the right place to do stories like that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, season two, like, you were canceled again after season two, which ended on a big cliffhanger, that
Yes,
we
it did.
got lucky was you guys were picked up for a movie to end things, which, thank goodness. But if there had been a season three, what's a plot line like that you had cut and you would have really liked to keep, or did you have any idea for
Oh my
season
God,
three before you were canceled?
we had so many season three stories that we would have told, but we would have mostly gone on doing, I think, things similar to how we did them in season two structurally. We wouldn't have probably mixed up the structure too much, because season two was only 10 episodes and it was really working for us. So, but we had tons of stories that we wanted to tell. We never got to go back to Berlin pre-Hitler. We never got to do Sybil Ludington in the Revolutionary War. We never got to do Edith Wilson, who was actually the first female president of the United States, because Woodrow Wilson was in basically in a coma for a period of time and she was running the country. We never got to do the Night Witches, who helped and who are the Russian female pilots in World War II. Like, I mean, I could go on and on of stories that I could honestly go on forever of stories we didn't get to tell, but we had lists and lists and lists of them. We could write books about them.
So, okay, it's a bit of a detail, but in one of the last episode of season two, the general, Gia goes and meets A former pilot who has been affected by time travel side effects. And he mentioned something about forbidden colors, and it's something that's always
Oh
stuck with me. And like, what are
my
those
God. I
forbidden
don't know,
colors?
man. I'm so sorry. I wish I could answer that. It wasn't an idea of mine, but I remember it coming up in the room, and I remember we thought it sounded cool. I'm sure somebody in the room has an explanation of what that meant. I wish I could tell you. I don't know. I'll be honest.
Oh no.
Gonna have to find
I
someone to
mean,
ask.
yeah. Who do we need to ask it?
Exactly.
But yeah. No, that's a good answer.
So kind of starting to wrap up, moving away from timeless, you've recently started your own show, The
Yes.
Irrational, and it's based on a book called Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. Can you tell us a bit more like about the show and like why you decided to adapt it from the book?
Sure. That is we're currently airing, we aired our first season. We now have a second season. I chose to adapt the book because it was given to me by a friend of mine, Mark Goffman, who's also an executive producer on that project. And he said, he was friends with Dan Ariely. He wanted to do a show about Dan and said, take a look at this and see what you think. And like, once you go down the Dan rabbit hole and you learn all of these human irrationalities, like it's very hard to, forget about it. And so just the idea of how much irrationality drives our behavior was very interesting to me. And Mark and I both saw an opportunity in making a procedural television show with somebody who solves cases from this human behavior perspective. And so it seemed like a really fun idea to me to attempt to, I mean, it's a nonfiction book about human irrationality. So there was no plot line. There was nothing to really hold on to in terms of making it a show. So I had to kind of create it from whole cloth. But it's been really fun. It's been one of the greatest experiences of my life working on this show. And we are currently making our second season as we speak. So you guys,
Wow.
if you haven't watched it, you should check it out on NBC or on Peacock.
Definitely. I finished the I watched the first season as it was airing, and I definitely the end took me by surprise, not gonna lie. Like I didn't see the end coming at all, but it was good.
I
So I'm
like
definitely
twist
looking forward to season two.
endings. Yes, you're very good at that. All right, to wrap up, you kind of answered that a little bit, but our traditional end question is, if you were to write one more episode of Timeless, which historical period or historical character would you center it on?
Oh my gosh, there's so many, as I told you, there's so many of them. Anne Frank is one I would love to do. And like I said, there's also the Night Witches, there's Sybil Ludington. I can't pick just one.
That's fair
those
enough.
are uh, those
That's
the, those
fair.
are those are just some of those are just some of them. Yeah.
All right. Well, we know you're very busy, so we're gonna let you go. Thank you so much again for coming on and talking to us. It
No
means
problem.
the
Thanks for
world
having
to
me.
us. That's it for today. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Erica. Once again, a big thank you to Erica for speaking with us. And thank you to Erica's assistant, Patrick Groff, and NBC Universal for helping us set up the conversation. If you haven't already, check out Erica's new show, The Irrational, before season two starts. It's on NBC and Peacock. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Thread. We're at BIT Lifeboat on Twitter and at Back in Lifeboat on Instagram, Threads, and Facebook. Rate and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, Podbean, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps the show grow and it helps people find us. Spread the word to any of your friends or family who are Timeless fans so they can reminisce and watch along with us or watch along with us for the first time. In our next episode this Tuesday, we'll be covering season two, episode six, titled The King of the Delta Blues. And we'll also have a special interview with Anslem Richardson, who wrote the episode. So stay tuned for that. It's a great interview. Please watch and email us your thoughts at backinthelifeboatpod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And as usual, shout out to Manny, who edits, produces the shows, and does the interviews with me too. We'll see you next Tuesday. Bye.